Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello and welcome to Rewatchability, part of the Entertainment One podcast network. I'm J.M. McNabb, joined by a very special guest today. It's a guest who's been on the show before. It's our friend Sina Ramani. Hey, Sina.
Hello. And lovely to be back.
Oh, well, thanks for coming. It's just going to be the two of us today. We're going to do something a little bit different. And I do want to thank all of our Patreon donors and say that we're sorry that it's been another bit of a gap between the last time we did an episode. We've all been beset by illnesses and work, and Blaine was beset by a baby.
What? I didn't know that.
You didn't?
No. How did I miss that?
I guess you don't listen to the show.
I listened to the Uncle Buck episode.
We were in the delivery room podcasting live. No, but we did mention it.
You did mention it. I must have missed that.
Yeah, Blaine.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
Blaine.
Well, he's not.
That's exciting.
He's not going to hear this. But we had, at least I had a rough couple of weeks. I had a cold and like weeks of stomach food poisoning thing. No one wants to hear about that because it's Christmas and that's not what Christmas is about. Or maybe it is. I don't know. We wanted to do a few episodes before the year wrapped up to actually deliver some episodes before the holiday season is over. So hopefully everybody will be back next week to do something a bit more conventional. But Sina and I had an idea that we concocted that is a little bit different. It deviates a little bit from our usual template of rewatchability, and I'm excited about it because what we're going to do is we're going to talk a bit more broadly about probably one of the most adapted stories of all time, not just Christmas stories, but of any story, and that is Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. And we have talked in the past about a few adaptations specifically, like we did Scrooged on the show. We talked about The Muppet Christmas Carol, obviously, but Sina, you are a recovering academic.
Yes. And even then, I'm a recovering Disney. I'm a recovering Dickens expert.
Disney bought Charles Dickens. His name is Charles Disney now. That's how you have to refer to him.
Why did I say Disney? Yeah, I wrote a dissertation on Charles Dickens plays a pretty big role in at least my PhD dissertation. I wrote a chapter. It's about orphanhood. The entire project is called Blank Subjects, and it's about the rise of what I call a kind of I kind of make the case for looking through the thematic of what I call orphanhood and not look at individual orphans. So even though a lot of people notice the fact that, you know, there's a whole huge history of orphans, especially in like kind of 19th century and 18th century British literature, that the kind of conversation got stuck at this idea of the orphan, you know, kind of people using this thing, like, which is kind of like out of date, right? Like nobody talks about archetypes. Archetypal criticism like went out the window. So I kind of set about like talk about orphanhood and you know, you can't talk about orphanhood in the British novel without talking about Charles Dickens.
That guy loves orphans.
He loves orphans. And I made a case against Oliver Twist, and I made a case for Great Expectations as like a far more profound and interesting and powerful sort of narrative of orphanhood, whereas the goal of Oliver Twist is kind of to correct this kid and reconnect him to his parents and his lineage. You know, the story of Great Expectations is really interesting, and it's about adopting people and like doing and like making connections outside of your family and going off into the world. And so I kind of, you know, I was kind of interesting. And just to bring it back to this conversation, you know, rereading Christmas Carol, I always was like kind of racist against Christmas Carol. Like I was like, oh, whatever. Because, you know, when you're a scholar.
Wait, how like, can you be racist?
Like you have to, you when you like focus on an author so deeply and you spend a lot of time reading it, you end up kind of like going towards a certain kind of figure of that author. So in the case of Dickens, a lot of people like sort of go towards late Dickens, right? Like the stuff that's like really heavy, the thick stuff. Like Great Expectations is like, you know, one of my favorites. And, you know, so that period of his life, and whereas this is like a different period, this is kind of like this is kind of mid period. I guess it doesn't really matter about periodizations, but it more to the fact that I definitely sort of shied away from this book, and rereading it now, and I reread it, and I also listened to a version of it, which we should talk about. Because I think that's like a huge thing with Dickens is like the prose is like audible.
Yeah, yeah.
But this book actually reminds me a lot of Great Expectations and the great things about Great Expectations. So this was a real treat for me to sort of dive back into this. And I also watched a bunch of movies and adaptations.
Yeah.
Some I had seen before. But anyways, that's my intro.
Yeah, you have a real Dickens background. You've read a lot of Dickens. You can speak very thoughtfully about that. And I've seen a lot of like mid-90s network television of which A Christmas Carol played a big part, so I think we'll meet in the middle and be able to talk about this.
It's commercial content. Chickens was a content factory. That's what they share in common,
right? Well, I we're not going to do like a rundown. Everybody knows the story of A Christmas Carol. It's this timeless classic that if you're not familiar with it, you are a robot sent here from another planet. So let's talk about the book first before we get into some of the movie versions and TV versions that we're familiar with. The book, I've read the book, but I read it a few years ago. I didn't reread it for this podcast. I'm not as committed as you, even though you're a guest.
But so, I know, I prepared more for this than any of my shows.
Well, it is a really short book. I listened to an audiobook version, or most of one as well, which we'll talk about. But tell me about like what hit you about reading it now that you didn't see necessarily in the past.
I'll tell you exactly what it is. So part of the kind of broader story of Charles Dickens' life and his work is that he became a kind of prisoner, and I'm kind of stealing this from a recent book by, is it Norton? Anne Norton?
Yes, of course.
I was just like checking it out the other day, and he kind of became like a prisoner, and it's a great way of sort of summarizing it. He became a prisoner of his own books, like a kind of character, because he lived this complicated life. Anyways, let's cut to the chase of this story, that this book is an important kind of launching point of a kind of a mode of writing that Dickens would return to again and again in the decades after, which is kind of memory and thinking about memory and using using memory as a place to manufacture like the act of recollecting as a way of writing a story. So what do I mean by that is that, you know, the main sort of thrust of this novel is jumping through time, is these various kind of supernatural figures, these three ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
They jump through time and they access this guy's life, right? And they access the sort of the character of Ebenezer Scrooge, who's this kind of miserly bureaucrat figure. Yeah,
just a real jerk.
The prototypical miser, prototypical bad boss, and you know, kind of in the modern sense,
horrible bosses.
Yeah, in the modern sense of bosses and employers, like industrial England. So part of, and again, sorry to just keep to keep doing this, but to understand the sort of era that Dickens is writing in, like I don't mean to be dramatic, but like this is like an apocalyptic time in the era that he lives in. Like smokestacks are billowing like clouds of death.
Right.
There is like the industrial violence of this era cannot be overstated. Like in the previous century, in like the previous like 75 years, like a certain class of people, the rise of a certain class of people in England, but this sort of replicated itself across the UK, and they kind of managed to, well, the UK didn't exist then, but anyways, the sort of broader history is that they managed to sort of rip out a whole way of being in the country. And because of the Industrial Revolution, labor was needed in the cities. And the cities that we know, the modern European cities, are really kind of come together in vast ways in the 19th century, right? And Dickens lives this time. He lives the kind of ground zero of this massive, like, apocalyptic, really, just like rivers are being flooded. There's this thing called the Great Stink, okay? Like, go look that up, where like there's so much shit washing up into the Thames and stuff, onto like the shores of it, that like causes the whole city to smell like shit for 2 months,
right,
in like a summer. Like, this is like untrammeled, or like what's the word I'm looking for? Like unhindered capitalism let loose upon what was essentially like an agrarian society, right? So like,
thank God we got that all sewn up.
Right, exactly. So like, you know, the air quality things now, you can't even imagine. And like work was brutal and hard, and there was no kind of labor struggles. Like, it's no accident that kind of Marx lives in London around the same time that Dickens does, towards the ends at least. But and Marx kind of lived that life of 19th century Europe that like you think of, like living in this dungeon, whatever. Anyways, lots of kids, like infant mortality, all these things. So to sort of just situate this story in kind of Dickens's career is to think about it, a kind of successful man, and this book brings him to new levels of success. But he had already established at this point, even though it's like, you know, he's a pretty big name, but like he's now kind of established enough and looking backwards in his life. And this book is, and the narrative's kind of arc is, these characters bring this guy who lives in the present day and only for the present day, and they force him to look back at his life, look around his life in the contemporary, and look into the future. And what he sees is so traumatizing that it forces him to like reconsider himself and reconsider his life. And really the one sort of narrative trick that I think of, that I never noticed before, is that they use this thing of like when the Christmas passed, is that he uses a cone on top of his head, like the sort of how they explain it, because it is a realist novel in the way, even though it breaks the rules of that, it's like it falls into this kind of fable, but it's still kind of realism. And the way that, which is why it starts with like, you know, Jacob Marley was dead. The Marleys was dead was Muppet Christmas Carol. Yeah.
I love that it's Jacob and Robert.
Yes. Bob Marley. Yeah. But like, so like that thing, that narrative technique of like, oh, he puts it on like
the ghost of Christmas past.
Ghost of Christmas past kind of puts this thing on his head, and it sort of emanates all these memories, right? And like that was really powerful because essentially what this is that a guy walking through the novel of his own life.
Yeah.
The novelization, that somehow someone was writing all of this down, and now I'm walking through it, and now I'm forced to learn about the mistakes that I've made. So
I was
that
gonna
for
ask
me
you,
was really powerful.
I didn't reread this, but like I did want to talk about like the way the ghosts are described, and the way, because I think especially like the Ghost of Christmas Past doesn't really have in its cinematic adaptations like a common visual descriptor, or like any like each one seems to just, like, some are just a dude, some are like a little floating angel, some, you know, like they vary wildly. Whereas, you know, the present and the future seem to have like, you know, one's like a big dude in a robe, the other's, you know, like the Grim Reaper.
And a green robe, yeah.
Yeah, so like there are sort of like, there's a template for that, but the Ghost of Christmas Past always seems to be like a bit of a surprise. So what, do you remember what it says in the book for?
Yeah, I'm looking at it now.
It's a dude with a cone?
Okay, here we go. Even this, though, when Scrooge looked at it with increasing steadiness, was not its strangest quality. Here it is. But the strangest thing about it was from the crown of its head there sprung a bright, clear jet of light, by which all of this was visible, and which was doubtless the occasion of its using, in its duller moments, a great extinguisher for a cap, which it now held under its arm. Even this, though, when Scrooge looked at it with increasing steadiness, was not its strangest quality. For as its belt sparkled and glittered now in one part and now in another, and what was light one instant and another time and another at another time was dark, so the figure itself fluctuated in its distinctness, being now a thing with one arm, now with one leg, now with 20 legs, now a pair of legs without a head, now a head without a body, of which dissolving parts no outline would be visible in the dense gloom wherein they melted away. And in the very wonder of this, it would be itself again, distinct and clever as ever. Yeah, this is good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like, I can see reading that and being like, oh, let's just get Buster Poindexter in a taxi cab.
I mean, it's like, yeah, no, it's this. It really is this vision. I mean, the whole thing of Jacob Marley also confronting him is like him, the ghostliness of him. And so at one point, this like his jaw drops, right? And that. The best adaptation of that, I mean, I know we're not getting into that, but we should, but that's 100% Scrooged. The Bill Murray thing with, like, the best... Like, I mean, the fun thing about this book and the many adaptations of it is that you can... And this is true with Dickens in general, is that you can watch all these different people from different backgrounds and different contexts with different media limitations. Like, there's radio adaptations, a ton of them, right? So, like, with different limitations and different forms, take on this... You know, pretty straightforward story, right? Like, there's nothing really special about it. Like, but it, as we just read, each character has these kind of supernatural elements, even though it is a realist novel, right? Like, it's not a fantasy novel. It's not Harry Potter, right? Where, like, these are magical things that live in this world, where it's just like, this guy lives in a real bleak world of mid-19th century London.
Yeah.
Like, it's brutal. It's cold. He's eating gruel. You know, he's this lonely, miserly dude. He, like, you know, he's just kind of mean, a jerk. Nobody likes him. No family, nothing. Like an orphan, right?
Well, this I was going to ask kind you of that, orphanhood. Because obviously your focus, your background in terms of examining Dickens was in terms of orphanhood. What is the Scrooge background? Is he an orphan? I know he's kind of like sent away from his family, like boarding school or whatever. But do his parents die?
So, okay. Like, there's a lot of... There's a lot of the, I mean, even though I reread it, this is actually a hard question for me to read. There is, when they jump into his past, because now all I think of is Bill Murray and like him being watching TV as a kid, right. Like watching a Western. That's all I see. But like when they jump into his past, there's a kind of, he visits his friends and what was his name? WYSIWYG? Fozziwig, or whatever his name was. Fozziwig might have been something too. Yeah.
Fozziwig is definitely... I'll give you a clue for figuring it out. If the name contains the name of a Muppet, it's probably from the Muppet one.
Bob Marley, that's still so good.
I know, like, in the... Not to jump too far ahead, because we're going to talk about the movie versions in a second, but in, like, the Alistair Sim movie, I was reading that one of the additions... That was the idea that Scrooge's nephew, who he's such an asshole to, was, I don't know if he was explicitly an orphan, but the idea was that his mother died in childbirth, and who was Scrooge's sister, who he loved, and that's why he's so mean to him. And I love the fact that that movie was just like punching up Dickens, whereas like, and totally successfully, but like, you know, they were like looking at the story and being like, well, I think we need a reason why he's just such a jerk to this poor guy.
A few of us are endeavouring to raise a fund to buy the poor some meat and drink and means of warmth.
Why?
Because it is at Christmas time that want is most keenly felt and abundance rejoices. What can I put you down for?
Nothing.
You wish to be anonymous?
I wish to be left alone. Since you ask me what I wish, sir, that is my answer. I help to support the establishments I have mentioned. Those who are badly off must go there.
Many can't go there, and some would rather die.
If they would rather die, they'd better do it and decrease the surplus population. Besides, it's not my business.
Isn't it, sir?
No.
Yeah. Some versions really make him more... they really embellish, like the Muppet version, for instance. They make him a landlord, and he's evicting people on Christmas Day. Like he doesn't do that in the novel.
Wait, in the Muppet version, he is.
Yeah, like Michael Caine is like he's forces the rats to sign eviction notices. There's like a stack of them.
I remember he does that in the Disney, like the Mickey's Christmas Carol. He's also like,
oh wow,
he like forecloses on his fiance's house or something. Like he's really bad.
Yeah. They make these choices and embellishments. Like actually a really, I mean, again, we're jumping into this too early, but like a good thing to, with these movies and with these Dickens adaptations, you can usually find like a few, at least definitely one that's extremely loyal to the original text, yeah. Like almost to a fault. And in this case, that's the George C. Scott from the 80s. It's like, it's sometimes word for word, a lot of times it's word for word, but it's, it captures a lot. George C. Scott at first is like a silly Ebenezer Scrooge because he's like, I don't know, he's not great.
Yeah.
But the way that sometimes it's good to watch those original ones I found, or not the original ones, but those ones that are kind of intentionally close to the original, and to use those as a kind of like weight to think about the other ones. That's not exactly fair to the other ones or actually to that one too, but
yeah,
but it is useful.
I kind of like that, like, you know, the book is its own thing, but it almost becomes like, you know, like a folk story or something where it's like it gets passed down so many times that, like, you know, a later version, you know, starts to incorporate things from a previous telling that wasn't necessarily in the original book. Like another addition that the Alistair Sim one made was the idea that like Scrooge's former girlfriend or fiance or whatever was in the present day, like working with like the poor, like she got involved in charity, which is another thing that Scrooge like
that's where
really
Scrooge
took.
Got it from. Yeah.
So I do love that there's this kind of like, yeah, like weird like oral storytelling tradition, but in like movie and TV form. But well, let's get into some of the movies, because I know you watched some early adaptations. You were texting me. Did you watch the very first live action movie version from 1901?
No,
it was called Marley. I think it's called Marley's Ghost. And
okay.
It was like 6 minutes long and only 3 minutes have survived until now, but they're all on YouTube and you can watch it. It's pretty impressive for 1901. It's a lot of like super imposition and stuff. But because it was just 6 minutes long, like they really condensed it. So Jacob Marley is the only ghost, which, it's kind of a good edit in a way. Like you can see an editor getting that and be like, Chuck, bring it down to one ghost. You don't need four ghosts. Like one ghost shows up and then tells him the three more ghosts are coming. So it's just Jacob Marley being like, here's your past, here's your present, here's your future, and I'm out.
But it's with commercials.
Yeah. But it was kind of interesting to see. Which was the one that you watched that you sent me?
That was from 1910.
Okay.
And this is an Edison silent film directed by J. Searle Dawley. And it's one of the earliest ones. It features Mark McDermott as Ebenezer Scrooge. And yeah, this, and it's like, it's 13 minutes.
Okay.
So this is a bit longer.
The first feature, I think, was something called The Right to be Happy in 1916.
Oh, wow.
I didn't watch that one, but the first one on this list that I'd actually like seen previously was the 1938 Reginald Owen one, which is another one that, you know, gets played.
I haven't seen that.
I remember it being okay. It's one that gets played on TV from time to time. But of course, the big one that people, you know, that I grew up with that, you know, gets played on TV every year is the 1951 Alistair Sim version, which was just called Scrooge in the UK, and I think was called A Christmas Carol here. I mean, this movie is a classic. I don't know how you feel about it.
I watched it before, like ages ago, and then I rewatched it. Obviously Alistair Sim is like one of the two best Scrooges. We can like argue about that, but like just, you know, how it's like, you know, whatever, like one of the greatest. Isn't he like one of like up there with what's his name, with Richard Burton and stuff, like in terms of the caliber of, he's like a whatever. But like he, there is that. But that version, I found the Tiny Tim to be so ridiculous.
He's like 8 feet tall.
Yeah, he does not look sick at all. Is like he and then you know what I realized? I was like, oh my god, Tiny Tim is Willy Wonka from the 60s Willy Wonka movie. Like that's where that guy got that. Looks like him, same kind of vibe. The actor was just doing that. I was like, oh. So I found that kind of silly.
There were
a lot of additions to the Alistair Sim version. There's a lot of padding around those sections. I found the Ghost of Chris. You know what else I thought about? It reminded me of, and we've seen so many versions of this because of the frame story element. The frame story is this Ebenezer Scrooge guy like looking back at his life with these three supernatural beings who kind of show up at his house with like no explanation. And like that frame story element is apparent in other Dickens books. But like here, it reminded me of, especially the first one, like the childhood thing, it reminded me of not just What a Wonderful Life, but also It's a Wonderful Life and Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
Of the act of, and once again, to repeat what I said earlier, like the act of recollection and memory as a kind of engine for your pen, you know, to kind of write the story and kind of get to watch it unfold. Because, you know, the implotment of this story is weird, right? Like, not much happens.
Yeah.
Like, it starts outside of his house. He goes to his house and he falls asleep and he has these, like, nightmares. And then he wakes up. And it's like, you know, it's all in one night. It ends up being all in one night.
Yeah.
And that is a pretty simple story, but it's the memories that make it so memorable, right? Like it's the, and not just, I guess the first one of the memories, but the second one is the switch to the kind of supernatural thing of let's go around and look at what's happening around you. That's the narrator. It's basically like some characters play the role, like these ghosts play the role of the omniscient narrator who introduces the reader, who's Scrooge, to his own life, to, like, the novel of his own life.
And it's telling the story, like, out of order to a certain extent.
Right.
Too. Like,
right.
I mean, it's almost like, you know, in a way, like, it anticipates even, like, later works like, you know, Slaughterhouse-Five and stuff like that.
Right.
Where it's like, we're using the idea of time travel, but we're basically just telling, like, a guy's life story in a slightly different way. I mean, yeah, It's a Wonderful Life, definitely. Like, I mean, that gets, you know, propped up as, like, the greatest Christmas movie for a lot of people, but I mean it owes a lot to this story and Christmas in general. Like, maybe you can contextualize this for me a bit better, but like I was reading like that at the time, partly why this book was so huge and why, like, you know, we didn't talk about how like Dickens, you know, would perform this and, you know, it added to his celebrity in terms of like a, you know, he was almost like a rock star, like going around just like performing a Christmas carol. But like I was reading that at the time, obviously, that you, like you were saying, it was a real stinkhole in London at that time. But like that Christmas was kind of on the outs, like people were not celebrating Christmas or it was not as popular. And this story, this one story, like really revitalized the idea of celebrating Christmas at that time in England. Is that true?
Yeah, generally it's true. I think there's a lot of written about this. There's like that movie, right? The Man Who Invented Christmas.
Yeah, I never watched that.
Yeah, I probably will now, but like,
yeah.
Because it's Christopher Plummer, right? Like, which is pretty awesome. Like, how many times you get to see that? But, you know, part of the story behind that, it's that, okay, so Dickens he's a commercial author. Like, he is a, like, mass cultural phenomenon, and because at the time of his life, like a huge author, like the biggest in the world, going around not just England but across the world giving these readings, traveling the globe, like he embodied a literary authorship that had never really been seen in that kind of world before. Now, is it because of Dickens or is it because of the time he lived in, where, remember, this is a time where hundreds of millions of people come under the reign of the Union Jack. Like, the British Empire is reaching, he gets to watch it, you know, however much you want to describe its peak and stuff. But in terms of its kind of consumption of the world, this is going full steam during his time. And he sees these transformations. And so part of what happens too is mass cultures get invented during the time of his life and in the aftermath too, and partly because of him, but also partly related to the fact that, like, he's an object of mass cultural consumption, right? His name. So, like, yeah, it's like a chicken and the egg thing. It's like, oh, do they make adaptations about him because they're profitable, or are they profitable because they make adaptations about him, right? Like which one is it? Like, is it, or is it, like, popular because it's canonical, or is it canonical because it's popular, right? Like, why do canons exist? And Dickens embodies for a lot of time, like, the idea of a canon. And also there is a Dickens industry, right? Not just in terms of the adaptations of his work. And he was the first member of that industry. Okay. He was a commercial guy. Like, he thought, he edited books. He released, like, publishing by serialization was a commercial choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. That was at the time.
So, also, like, let's be honest, a laziness choice.
Well, this guy was absolutely, like, he was hyper beyond all measure. He was doing 20 things at once, and then he would go on like 6-hour walks at, like, night. Like, the guy had, like, you know, a ton of energy. This thing of his, though, is that he produced so much work, and it was a universe of characters. It was like a world. And so kind of today, when we talk about Marvel Universe, DC Universe, like, Dickens was one of these early progenitors. And he wasn't the only one at his time. Even Thomas Hardy's novels, who was kind of his contemporary, he had, like, a universe of characters, a shared universe in this kind of fictional place. So, like, this is a time when authors are writing books.
I just can't help but, like, get over the image of you as, like, a desperate librarian at a school being like, you kids love the Marvel Universe. You love the DC Universe. Let me introduce you to the Dickens Universe.
Do you know about Uncle Pumblechook, folks? He's a real banger.
He was the original Iron Man.
I know there is this mode of being like, did you like this, kids? Well, Dickens did it. And, like, that's a big mode of Dickens criticism. But, like, part of it has to do with the fact that, yeah, like, mass culture as we understand it, that got exported to the world, like, really violently, right?
Yeah.
Like, we're speaking English, like, for a reason, because because people in the era that Dickens lived in hopped on boats and went and, like, took part in, like, the colonization of the world. Like, Dickens' dad was, like, a Navy clerk. Like, he was part of it, you know, like, that was, like, Dickens, like, circulated the globe on this kind of circulation of commodities that was kind of, you know, its foundations were dug by the violence of the Navy in, like, the 17th, 18th, and, like, 19th centuries, like, 18th, 19th, more realistically, right? Like,
yeah.
And he also lived through incredibly violent time, like, again, all those, like, incredible amount of violence. And so part of the success of Dickens as a mass author was his books were consumed, and they were really beloved, and people would then want to be around him. They would go to his readings, and he was a kind of celebrity author. And along with that came these things surrounding his books and the phrases. And then, but then part of the complication here is that it's the Dickens sort of memorial industry that rises, like, basically, like, around the time of his death, you know, like, people were obsessed with talking and thinking about Dickens. I mean, he famously burned all his letters, like, one night, just to, like, he's like, ah, screw you people, you're not gonna know this, and they, like, burned them, because he, like, didn't want people, and so, like, you know,
it's the old-timey equivalent of, like, clearing your browser,
doing your hard drive, or clearing your search history, clearing your hard drive. You know, like, this was a guy who was conscious, very conscious about his legacy.
Yeah.
And so in some ways, the fact, like, these traditions around this and the consumption of his name and the linkage of his name. Now I definitely have to go watch this movie. I mean, I'm sure there's, like, you can make complaints about it.
Yeah, I think my parents saw it. But in terms of, like, specifically, like, the celebration of Christmas, like, I get that, like, the popularity of it may have also made Christmas more popular at the time, but I think there's also something to this story as this, like, predominant Christmas story that really, like, ushered in, I'm guessing, like, it really helped usher in the way we celebrate Christmas today, which is very for you know, a large part of the population, very secular, right? Like, I love Christmas, but I'm not religious at all. And I think part of the reason why people like me grew up loving Christmas is, like, that we have all of these Christmas mythologies that are so separate from, like, the birth of Jesus, you know, like one of them being
secularized.
A Christmas Carol, you know, Santa, obviously. But I feel like A Christmas Carol, A, is completely secular. I mean, there are some references to religion in the story, but not a whole lot.
Yeah, it's humanism to the core.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And two, I think, like, part of the reason why this endures and is so popular is because it can appeal to kids. Like, there's cartoon versions, there's the Muppet version, but it's also like a very you almost age into it. Like, it's about an old man thinking about his regrets in life. Like, it's like Wild Strawberries or something. Like,
it's, well, Great Expectations too. Great Expectations, it's written by the older Pip.
Oh, okay.
And he's remembering his life, and it's an old man looking backwards and reassessing things. And that reassessment is what the reader sort of encounters, because he sort of that, and that's the narrator's role. And that's what's so interesting in a lot of Dickens' stuff, is like the sort of the different, the kind of all the different figures who come together. Like some of it, like Bleak House, famously, one of the characters, like one of the narrators, is like, I think there's like different narrators of it who take over, and one of them is like the voice of Esther Summerson. Right, like one of the main characters. So he adopts the voice of like a young girl, which is like something he does in like a few other stories. And it's like, you know, the guy wrote so much over his life, just the sheer amount of stuff that he wrote and left behind. You know, you can find anything of everything. But the Christmas thing is particularly important here. I'm going to read a quote. This is from the Oxford Modern World Classics intro. Where was it? Here it is. Here we go. Originally written as a tract for the Times, this cautionary tale about the ongoing tussle between greed and goodness has been thought of as timely whenever it has been read. Enjoyed by its first reader as a modern expression of the spirit of Christmas, as modern as Christmas cards, which were sent for the first time in the same year as the Carol's publication, it has since become popular for quite different reasons. The sense of tradition it is thought to embody, a reminder of the simple pleasures that seem to have been lost sight of in seasonal scrum of shoppers, an annual invitation to the pleasures of nostalgia. Reproduced so often and in so different forms, it has become as much a part of Christmas as mince pies or turkeys, with the key difference that, as Martin Heidegger argued, was true of all classic works, it has never been, quote, used up. There have been dozens of films starring everyone from Laurence Olivier and Ralph Richardson to Mr. Magoo and Mickey Mouse, operas and ballets, an all-black musical, Benjamin Britten's Men of Goodwill, even a BBC mime version in 1973 starring Marcel Marceau.
Well, that just sounds like the worst.
So regular are the annual returns of the Carol to our stages and screens, in fact, that has become something like a secular ritual, he called it, an alternative Christmas story to its more obviously religious rival, in which the three wise men are replaced by three instructive spirits.
Oh, that's true.
And the pilgrimage to a child in a manger is replaced by a visit to a house of Tiny Tim. Even people who have never read Carol...
Man.
Yeah.
It's the opposite of a baby.
Even people who have never read the Carol know the story of Scrooge, the miserable old skinflint who repents after being visited by the ghost of Christmas past, ghost blah 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 blah. So wildly and deeply has this story entered the popular imagination that phrases such as "bah humbug" have floated free of their original context and acquired the force of common proverbs, while Scrooge himself has entered the language as a piece of cultural shorthand, quote, used elusively to describe a miserly, tight-fisted person or killjoy.
Yeah. I was thinking about, do you remember when we were kids at Canadian Tire?
Canadian Tire?
They had
that.
They had an ad campaign that was like, give like Santa, save like Scrooge.
Like, and it'd be Scrooge, Santa Scrooge. Oh my God.
Which always bothered me, because it's like, the whole point of the story was that, was to curb that impulse, was to be generous and not cheap.
It's to not, and not to think about money. Right, not think in terms of like the money aspect.
One thing I do want to say, I want to move on to some of these other film versions, but still staying on the Alistair Sim one for a second. There's a moment in that I don't know if it's from the book. It probably is, and I don't know if it's. I don't remember it being in any other film adaptations, but it's the moment between when he closes up his office and when he goes home. He goes for dinner.
Yes,
and
dinner.
Is that in the book?
I think it's mentioned in the book, okay. But the scene in it isn't. Yeah,
because the scene is like he's eating bread and he calls the waiter over and he says, more bread. And the waiter's like, it's a halfpenny extra. And he goes, no more bread. And it's, and I think it's such a key scene because, well, he's so good in it, Alistair Sim, but also it's a key scene because it also shows that like Scrooge isn't just, it's not just that he hates people. It's that also that he's like cheap to himself. Like he shortchanges himself. And that
first and foremost,
like he has all this money and he won't even pay a halfpenny for the bread he wants on Christmas Eve. It's it just encapsulates a lot about what is great about that character. A couple other things I wanted to mention. I've watched this movie so many times, often with my dad. It's his favorite Christmas movie. And so we've noticed a lot of like weird things in it. I mean, like the British film industry was not as often as high budgeted as like the Hollywood equivalent at that time. So like there are some like weird continuity errors in this movie. My dad always points out that there's a scene where like Scrooge looks out the window that Jacob Marley shows him, and it's all the like ghosts, all the like disembodied souls, and there's this creepy music. They, I guess, didn't have enough extras because one of the ghosts is Bob Cratchit. It's the same actor. And the other hilarious mistake is at the end of the movie, if you watch, there's a part where Scrooge is, you know, redeemed and he is happy and he runs over to the mirror and looks at himself in the mirror and you can see like a crew member behind him like shuffling around. And I always like to joke that that's one of the Christmas ghosts who like, you know, left his keys in Scrooge's bedroom. But it's great. And just before we leave Alistair Sim, I do want to mention that something I didn't realize about this movie or about his performance is that he reprised the role of Scrooge. Did you know this?
No.
For a 1971 short animated film directed by Richard Williams, who's from Toronto and who did the animation for Roger Rabbit and some other stuff. He did that movie. Is it The Thief and the Cobbler? It was like this movie he was trying to finish for like decades. But famous animator, and it was produced by Chuck Jones.
Oh, wow.
And it's fantastic. It's all on YouTube. It's only like 25 minutes. It's great. Like, I mean, it's Alistair Sim doing the voice, so that's great. And then, I mean, he sounds a lot older, but it works, obviously. And then some scenes are like genuinely scary, like the animation, like Jacob Marley is terrifying. It's phenomenal. Like, I'd never heard of it, and I was reading like Vox wrote an article about how it's the best adaptation ever, like of A Christmas Carol. It's really good. It won the Oscar for best short film that year.
Wow.
It's fantastic. Like I said, it's all on YouTube. Next up, I wanted to talk about the 1970 Albert Finney version, which is a musical called
Scrooge.
I've
never seen that.
Man, I'd never seen all of it. I've seen parts of it on TV and I watched some of it today. It's crazy. It's pretty good. Like, I love Albert Finney. Alec Guinness plays Jacob Marley. And, there's one really crazy scene where, you know, at the end when the Ghost of Christmas Future, you know, shows him his grave, in the big climactic scene, instead of just like seeing his grave or like falling into the, you know, the plot, or I feel like that's, you know, another element of the story that's always being changed or modified, or like, you know, adaptations are being like picked up on by other adaptations. But in that version, Scrooge falls into the hole next to the grave and continues falling until he's in the bowels of hell. And it's just literally like this like bright red, you know, set, like this very phony looking set, but it's all red and smoky and like there's just this fake stone. And then Jacob Marley comes and is like, oh, you're dead, welcome to hell, or you know, something to that effect. He's like, let me show you your room. it's so weird. So that's a weird one. Mickey's Christmas Carol, 1983, was a short Disney film that was I think on a re-release of The Jungle Book or something. But that was the first one I saw when I was a kid.
First one I saw was actually Scrooged.
Really?
That was like the first, yeah, I remember, yeah. And so that's been the kind of the what I used to sort of judge the rest of them. Although now that I've reread the novel, it's like it means the Scrooge adaptation actually means much more to me now. I was like, wow, that was really subtle. Those are like really subtle decisions they made.
Right. So the George C. Scott one you mentioned, you just watched that recently. I watched that a long time ago, and I remember just not buying When He's Nice at the end, because I just find George C. Scott kind of creepy.
He's kind of goofy, but if you could just get over that, how goofy he is, then it's actually a fun adaptation to just use as a kind of plumb line to watch the other ones.
Mr. Cratchit!
The fire's gone cold, Mr. Scrooge.
Come over here, Mr. Cratchit. What is this? A shirt. And this?
A waistcoat.
And this?
A coat.
These are garments, Mr. Cratchit. Garments were invented by the human race's protection against the cold. Once purchased, they may be used indefinitely for the purpose for which they are intended. Cold burns.
I mean, Scrooged, obviously, we've talked about. The Muppets, we've talked about. I mean, that, for my money, might be the best version. Michael Caine's just so good in it. No, you don't agree?
That one is great. That I love. I have a confession. I actually had never seen it until...
What?
Like, I'd known about it. Like, I had only watched The Muppets recently. Like, I watched, like, the Manhattan movie... Like when I was living in New York, just as like lark, I was like,
Woody
"Oh, this
Allen.
Is what." But I was like, "Oh, this is why people love the Muppets. Muppets Take Manhattan, right?" And I was like, "Oh, this is why people love them."
That's
because
like
I just,
the
I
worst
knew the,
one. Why
I knew
would
the
you
cartoon.
Start with...
I don't know. It was just on or something. I knew the cartoon Muppet Babies. That's what I knew them from.
Oh my
so
god!
So watching
How
this,
have we not talked about this.
I know. I was never a Muppets fan. But watching this, first of all, Michael Caine is amazing. He's actually
so good.
Bob Cratchit?
Yes, Mr. Scrooge?
Who is this?
It's Mr. Applegate, sir. He's here to speak to you about his mortgage.
Please, Mr. Scrooge, I know you're very angry about this, and I didn't mean to fall behind in the payments. Lord knows it, being Christmas and all. Oh, please don't shout at me, sir. That and, of course, little Gwen. Her lungs aren't right. The doctor takes his share, don't he? I mean, you can yell and scream, and you're right, but it won't do no good, because I'm the stone you can't squeeze blood from, and that's the truth! Thank you for not shouting at me!
Bob, like, Miss Bob Cratchit, as like Kermit as Bob Cratchit, is amazing. Because Bob Cratchit, ultimately, and this is kind of like the darker side of this, is like this is like a story of like, oh, if you're, like, I don't know, okay, people demand of their books different, like, they want, sometimes you read a book, you're like, how come this doesn't, I disagree with the political message of this, which is fine or whatever, but then it's, you can't, like, kind of force the author, you can't kind of project those feelings back onto the author. So I'm taking a risk in doing that as I say this, but, like, you read this novel now in the kind of general tenor of it, which is, you know, put away your obsession with commodities and wealth and this meaningless thing, and embrace the family life around you. And the thing about Bob Cratchit, though, is that this guy is abused to no end by this terrible man who abuses him, and his child is dying as a result
it's
of...
It's going to take more than the turkey to turn
like,
that around.
Like, his house isn't warm, right? So this kid is dying, doesn't have the necessary... Like, he's been killing this kid this whole time.
Yeah.
And the underneath, and Dickens is often accused of this, is that, oh, if you just sort of agree to the rules of liberal charity, then, or like liberal kind of like humanism, then, you know, you can kind of like redeem yourself. Now, this is complicated, and it depends on the era that he's writing in and whatever, blah, blah, blah. This is simplifying like a man with a very complicated background. But that underlying kind of shriekly, what's the word I'm looking for? The word people always use is sentimentality, right?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of sentiment. There's a lot of feeling. Like, Dickens was an earnest guy. Like, he wasn't like a... I mean, he was many things in his life. But on paper, like, these, like the way... Especially towards... Like, especially in those early eras. Like, you read Oliver Twist, which is, like, his first kind of novel. Because before that is different. It's like Pickwick Papers. And they're kind of different than that. But, like, Oliver Twist, which was, like, a big sensation... The narrator is basically Dickens. It's like this annoying guy who's very like, you know, kind of like very self-serious and whatever. And then there's like the late guy, there's like David Copperfield, and there's Great Expectations, and it's this kind of like rugged dude. He's been living this double life. Like, Dickens lived the total double life. He had this secret marriage. Everybody should read or watch the movie The Invisible Woman about Ellen Ternan, his like his younger, you know, they say mistress and stuff, but it was basically his partner and stuff. He had two wives, essentially. Yeah,
wasn't one of them a teenager?
Yeah, Ellen Ternan. Like, he met her when she was a teenager. Dickens, I did have something very controversial to tweet that I'm only going to give to listeners of this episode, which is, if he were alive today, he'd probably be wrapped up in Epstein, because the man did have a unhealthy interest with young women.
Yeah.
And assuming their name, like, you know, kind of being close to, I mean, and she was very young when they met. And
where were the Christmas ghosts warning him not to do that?
Yeah, exactly. So like, a lot of here's the creepy thing. They were in public together. They were seen in public together because they spent a lot of time together. And the explanation of why this guy was like hovering around her is that he was like her mentor avuncular dude.
You're ruining Muppet movies.
I'm not going to ruin it. Sorry.
Moving on, I do want to mention the 1999 Patrick Stewart version.
Oh, my God. I didn't get around to watching this. I just learned about it from you.
I watched some of it. I have the audiobook I was listening to is the Patrick Stewart audiobook, because he did it as a one-man show. He basically did what Dickens did. He did kind of like an abridged version that he just performed the whole book. And
yeah,
I do enjoy the movie version because he's good in it and the audiobook's great. But man, I wish there was just a filmed version of him doing that show. I do want to mention, it's still worth watching. Richard E. Grant, the great Richard E. Grant, is Bob Cratchit. And Fred, the nephew, is played by McNulty. Dominic West.
What? McNulty? McNulty? What are you doing there?
There is a 2001 animated movie called Christmas Carol, the movie. Speaking of Orson Welles, his biographer, Simon Callow, does the voice of Scrooge. Kate Winslet is Belle. And you'll never guess who plays Jacob Marley. It's Nicolas Cage.
Oh, my God. What was the movie what's my favorite movie of all time? National Treasure fame.
Yeah. Then there's, did you see that Jim Carrey, Robert Zemeckis version from a few years ago? Oh my God. It was creepy. I'm either having a stroke or Gary Oldman was Bob Cratchit with that horrible motion capture, uncanny valley look. Yeah. It was terrifying. I saw it in the movie theater. There was a recent, mini series on FX with Guy Pearce that was, the kind of hook of that, I think I haven't watched it, but I was thinking about watching it this year. The hook of that is that it's actually like leaning into the horror. It's trying to be scary.
I think I got that. That's the vibe I got from the poster.
Yeah, yeah. Could be interesting. Like, there are even weirder adaptations of this story that I want to talk about in a minute. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
We're back on Rewatchability, part of the Entertainment One podcast network. We're talking about all the different adaptations of A Christmas Carol with Sina Ramani. Sina, this is a great work of English literature, right?
Oh, yeah.
So naturally, it was used as the plot in a bunch of sitcoms.
Like sitcom episodes?
Yeah, like a ton. I was looking at too many to mention. I mean, there's too many adaptations to mention. There are just so many. But I do want to talk about some of the weirder ones. Did you ever see the Saved by the Bell one?
No, my God.
Did you see the Family Ties one?
Probably, but I blanked it from my memory.
How about the Blackadder one? Did you ever see that?
I saw that was available as an audiobook. Is it good?
It's great, yeah, because the idea behind that is that they completely flip it. It's the Scrooge character, who's Blackadder, is the nicest person in England. And
oh.
The ghost comes to visit him, and it's Robbie Coltrane. And he's really just like popping by to say hi and say like, good job being so nice to everyone. But then he shows him his past and, you know, all the sort of previous Blackadder characters and sees how successful they are being mean, that by the end of it, it turns him into a horrible person. It's the complete reverse of the original
story.
I got
to see that.
It is actually very funny. It's been used as a lot of cartoons too, like on Looney Tunes and the Flintstones, Animaniacs, Ghostbusters. Did you ever watch the episode of The Real Ghostbusters that involved A Christmas Carol?
No, but I know the show.
It was an episode called Xmas Marks the Spot. And the plot is, zapped back in time to 1837 England, the Ghostbusters unknowingly trapped the ghosts of Christmas, thereby saving Ebenezer Scrooge from his scheduled rehabilitation. The future is challenged, and they must go back in time to change it. So I remember that being pretty good, actually. I think I watched it a few years ago. It's been used in a lot of sci-fi shows. Quantum Leap had a Christmas Carol episode where Al the hologram had to pretend to be a ghost. The X-Files did a riff on it with like a haunted house. And more pertinent to our concerns, you and me, Star Trek has made reference to it a lot. There was the episode where Data is acting out the story on the holodeck. You remember that?
Oh, yeah, you're right.
And then, like, they reference, like, on Voyager, they reference it a few times. And so there's an article on StarTrek.com about, like, hey, why has humanity seemingly evolved past celebrating Christmas? Because they never do that on any Star Treks. But this story, for some reason, is still like this cultural touchstone. And it's kind of an interesting article because they basically talk about some of what we've been talking about. It's like, you know, so much of the themes of that book like resonate with like the utopian ideal of the Star Trek world. Like, it's about, you know, embracing like humanity and rejecting, you know, profits and the economy or economic concerns. But yeah, so that was kind of interesting. Also in that article made reference to, and I can't believe I hadn't thought of this before, that the finale of Star Trek The Next Generation is basically the structure of A Christmas Carol, where Q is like the ghost and he's showing him the past, present, and future. And then he's slightly nicer at the end and goes to a poker game.
Yeah. Well, it's when you look at when you find a textualized version of your life, which is also the plot of our beloved comedy movie what's it called? Defending Your Life, right? Like,
you're confronted
with a novelization of your life. And when you read it the way that you would anybody, which is a biography, right? But because it's like, you know, written in that realist mode in all of these movies that we've cited, because it's memory, right? And so memory isn't fiction, right? Memory is something that, it's a picture of what happened, at least, you know, in the ideal way we think of memory. But in fact, it's the memory as a place to that we go visit to teach us about ourselves and to make us, you know, reconsider our lives, and that kind of like instructive element of the book, the kind of like moralistic thing, which Dickens is famous for.
And even in terms of like the movies, like the cinematic language of how we tell flashbacks, I think was inspired by this. Like, I was even just watching the show, you know, the show Yellowjackets.
No, I don't.
It's a new show. But anyways, there was a flashback, and the way they told the flashback was you kind of see the flashback, but you see the character who's thinking about it, like, in the scene as an adult, kind of watching herself as a kid. And, like, I would certainly doubt there was an earlier example of that sort of visual way of showing a flashback before a movie version of A Christmas Carol, where you're seeing the older self literally, you know, in the room witnessing their past. Like, it's just become such a common thing, but I'm sure that must have been because of A Christmas Carol.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, a lot of things, there's a temptation to be like, oh, Dickens is the first to do this. And like as I mentioned,
I don't mean Dickens, you know, necessarily. I'm saying,
but yeah, in the influence the movies. Of it. Yes,
because I don't even know, like, in the book, do they explicitly say, like, you know, that Scrooge is like in the room watching himself? Do they comment on that?
Well, no, they comment on that. I was noticing that in the thing about the cone, right? And then the Ghost of Christmas Present, now it's escaping me. How did the mechanics of the Ghost of Christmas Present work? Because
he's just a dude in a robe. And then we find out he's got like two little kids in that robe.
Yeah. No, that was the next guy, wasn't it?
No, that's a present. Remember,
oh, yeah, that's a present. He's got the two kids hanging out.
This little girl is wand, this little boy is ignorance. And
yeah.
It's like, dude, just leave the just let the kids go. I don't care what their names are. Don't keep two children under your robe. That's not cool.
And part of this, too, is that if like you're really interested in like the socio-historic background, is that the poor laws are this is part of the drama around the poor laws. And Dickens was before his life as a novelist, he was like a reporter. And he kind of watched a lot of legislation, a lot of sort of parliamentary action and flourish and drama go down. And he like reported it live in like articles and stuff for different publications. And a lot of that was like, okay, we've destroyed our country. What do we do now with these people who are dying on our streets?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And like the apocalyptic, like look, what's the book, The Ghost Map? There's a really good book about cholera that came out. The first couple of pages about
of
like mudlarking. Like the, yeah, like
that
it's
book
like
about
the
cholera. I couldn't wait to buy it.
No, but like the first pages illustrate like just the filth of this sort of like early industrial landscape of Victorian England.
And you know, and how, I was joking about that scene, but like that's a moment that doesn't get used in a lot of adaptations from my, it's certainly not in the Muppet one, but it, like it is such a chilling moment and it is very effective.
Which one? The
part where the two like emaciated children are on.
Oh, right.
The rope.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And Dickens himself was like involved with like social ventures and stuff. He like ran this like private girls' college called Urania College.
I'm a little suspicious of that now, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I want to talk. This was kind of part of his brand, is that he was like a social reformer. And if you watch that Invisible Woman Ralph Fiennes, you can see him. You can see the kind of moral crusading liberal that we still can recognize today.
Right.
Yeah, in there. Anyways, keep going.
I do just want to like rattle through some of the weirder adaptations, somehow even weirder than the one with Nicolas Cage as Jacob Marley. I mean, there are just so many, like there's so many versions of the story. We can't talk about them all. There, some of the ones like that I have a weird association with, Rich Little did a version of A Christmas Carol. You know, Rich Little, he was like an impersonator.
Okay.
I mean, I guess he still is. He's still alive. Hopefully nothing happens between when we record this and when we put it up. He's quite old, but yeah, he was a famous impersonator, and he did, you know, he'd go to like those celebrity roasts. He did albums. He did, you know, he's famous for doing like Nixon and Johnny Carson and, you know, impressions like that. So he did a version. I don't know if it was a TV special first or an album first. I actually have the album for some reason, but he did an album, which made slightly more sense because it's him doing the story of A Christmas Carol as celebrities. So it's kind of like on the back, it's like W.C. Fields as Scrooge, you know, like John Wayne as the Ghost of Christmas Past or whatever. So he's doing all the voices, but as famous celebrities. And it kind of works as a record, I guess. At the time, it works better, I'm sure. But he also did an HBO special in 1978 where he did the same thing. But so he's playing all the characters, like in these, it's sometimes wearing like weird makeup to try and make himself look like, you know, W.C. Fields or Richard Nixon or all these people. And it's terrible. It's just awful.
Oh, by the way, he's in the boat and bottle business.
Darn carolers. Hope they OD on happiness.
And what a business it was, too.
Good morning, Mr. Scrooge.
Ah, bad morning, bad morning, bad morning.
His assistant, Bob Cratchit, built the boats, and Scrooge emptied the bottles.
I'm dreaming of a tight Christmas.
It's kind of like what Dickens did in his life, too. He was like a real, he was like a real theater guy. He was a real, and he was connected to theater people. Like he made it part of his life. He really was like a multi-sport athlete. Like he did it all. It was like the image we have of him as like a novelist is partly as a result of the fact that it's people who study novels who mostly deal with him. But the guy was like living in his time, adapting his works and stuff like that. Like it was really like he was a content guy.
Right.
He was writing content. Like he would do very well on the internet today.
He would be Joe Rogan today.
Yeah. He would definitely have a podcast. Definitely.
I remember watching as a kid, there was a TV Western version of the story with Jack Palance called Ebenezer that I remember not liking. This I've never seen, but there was the first female Scrooge, like the first sort of gender swapped version was in 1995 with the Canadian TV movie Ebby starring Susan Lucci. There's a TV musical version with Kelsey Grammer as Scrooge. And
That'll be a good one.
Jason Alexander plays Jacob Marley. I don't know. I don't know if that would be a good one. There was a Hallmark TV. Again, there are just so many, but one I want to mention.
That's the thing. That's like Dickens, right? Like he was a furtive mind who created stuff, and it's still playing out.
Yeah, well, there's this Hallmark version from 2003 was called A Carol Christmas and starred Tori Spelling as the Scrooge character. The Ghost of Christmas Past was Gary Coleman, and The Ghost of Christmas Present was William Shatner. That's two Star Trek captains that have been in Christmas Carol movies. I do want to mention, lastly, if you haven't checked this out, I think you might get a kick out of this. But I remember hearing about a few years ago and watching some of, and I watched a little bit of it today as well. There was I guess you'd call it like a fan edit or a internet project. It's on YouTube. It's called 1200 Ghosts. And it's an almost hour long video that this guy made telling the story of A Christmas Carol, but using he used 400 different sources, 400 different tellings of A Christmas Carol and edited them all together into this one kind of video project that tells the story using movies and TV shows and even like video games and comics. Like it's pretty impressive. And like sometimes they use multiple clips at the same time in split screen or there's the image of something, but the voiceover of something else. It's kind of neat and really does like hammer home just how ubiquitous this story is.
Well, I released a radio play. I released a radio version produced by Orson Welles with Lionel Barrymore playing Scrooge.
Right.
It's on my podcast feed from, Christmas of last year.
Yeah. And that didn't Lionel Barrymore, wasn't he Mr. Potter in It's a Wonderful Life?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, like It's a Wonderful Life. People love that movie, but like it's about essentially a ghost showing somebody, or changing something in their past. And there is like literally a Scrooge character in it, but he doesn't get redeemed. I have heard, I think I wrote about this once, but I've never found like a great source for it, but it's long been rumored that in It's a Wonderful Life, the studio, maybe I've talked about this on the show too, but the studio forced Frank Capra to film a scene where the Scrooge character, Mr. Potter, has a heart attack and dies because Clarence the Angel scares him. Because they because they didn't like the idea that the villain was never punished.
Wow.
Because he just gets away scot-free with the $8,000 at the end of that movie. Have you seen It's a Wonderful Life?
Oh, of course.
Okay. I hadn't seen the Muppets before. I don't know.
Yeah, no, of course. I've seen it. I love It's a Wonderful Life, actually. It's great. I cry every single time at the end.
No, I cry when they fall in the swimming pool, but I'm weird.
Hee-haw,
well, let's kind of wrap up by asking...
We didn't talk about Scrooged.
Well, we did a little bit. I mean,
barely.
We did a whole episode about it, but it's great.
8 years ago.
Okay. It was a great... it's a great movie. I watch it every year.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
And I do like the versions that do have a creepiness to them, which I think Scrooged does. Like, it scared me when I was a kid.
It's just the right amount of creepy, of funny, of like random. It's got the translation, like the kind of conceptual update of like Scrooge being a nasty kind of 80s go-getter scumbag TV producer is so beautiful. Like, and the character of Bob Cratchit being
Bobcat Goldthwait. Alfred Woodard's really Bob Cratchit.
It's Alfred Woodard. It's Alfred
Cratchit. Bobcat Goldthwait doesn't really have an anonymous character.
Yeah, because the thing about him being this disgruntled employee, right? Like, they added that element. But, like, that ghost, I think, like the Jacob Marley, as I said earlier, I think that's the best one I've seen on screen. The character that who is the actor? I don't know who the actor is.
Oh God, it was, what's his name?
I want to think it's Jack Palance, but it's not Jack Palance.
He's in that Hitchcock movie. He's in Topaz, I think.
Okay,
God, what's his name? He's a famous actor.
You'll get it in a second. Crazy. But like, that scene is amazing. The ghosts are fantastic. We never talked about how Dickens divided it, which was he divided it into stave. Which is like,
oh, right, yeah,
the staff, right? Like, it's from music. It's like music bars. You know this, right?
Mm-hmm. I think I know it from A Christmas Carol, but yeah.
Yeah, no, but I mean it's something that stave is like a Christmas. It's like something from,
yeah,
something from music notation, right?
Yeah. I John Forsyth, by the way, is the name of.
Okay.
Oh, no, it's The Trouble with Harry he's in. That's the one. That's the Hitchcock movie, isn't it?
Oh, that's the Hitchcock movie, yeah, okay.
Stave, I'm not sure, is it like an opera thing? But it's like basically like a chapter for a musical piece.
Dickens would like often use these things, these different books. Like in Great Expectations, it's stage one, stage two. This is the closing of the first stage of thing, and it's kind of like related to stage coaching in each time.
Oh, no, it just says in British musical terms, it's another term for staff.
Right. So the thing for, what is the actual staff in music? Like the actual thing? Isn't it like the definition of staff? It doesn't matter.
I don't know.
Anyways, is that like,
I'm self-taught. I don't this stuff. But it is like, yeah, going back to the title of like A Christmas Carol, it's like giving it this kind of musical lyrical sense.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, okay, but to wrap up, like, let's decide what do you think is the most rewatchable version of A Christmas Carol? Because, I mean, it's easy to just say like A Christmas Carol, you kind of cycle through different versions every year. Like, but is there a version that you think is the best, or not necessarily the best, but the version that you think holds up the most for you right now, at age, I think you're in your early 50s.
I have to say Scrooge. I have to say Scrooge.
Really?
I'm
you
sorry.
Think that's the most rewatchable?
I think that's the most rewatchable. It's just, it's more, I don't know. Maybe I think in my non-academic years, I find that like the charm of like recreating Victorian England, it to me just kind of is like, I don't care anymore. Because remember, like there's a way that like when we picture the past, it's cleansed, right? Like it's cleansed of its kind of gritty whatever. I mean, Invisible Woman tries to capture some of that, but like this, you know, I can't help but think that like, we use Dickens to kind of not whitewash, but kind of just like remove the sort of unseemly aspect.
Like romanticize it?
Like romanticize it, but also kind of aestheticize it and just kind of make it folklore-y and just, whereas like this is an incredibly powerful society, a society made up of powerful individuals, right? And people like Scrooge are running this society and they are running the world in some ways, and their brutality to their workers is manifested tenfold and like, or 100 billion times fold on the global population, right? Like that, to the point where like, oh, like where he says surplus population, and that becomes like, you know, he's like talking these Malthusian terms, and like, this is how Victorian elites like spoke. Like they saw the world as like, we're going to use the world for our resources and plunder it until, and it's just exists for us. Right. And so an author like Dickens writing to that audience, it's interesting to think of it in these terms, you know, like of like trying to show that, oh, the good of humanity. But it's like, you know, for me today, I would want Bob Cratchit to like attack Scrooge.
Right, yeah.
And to like, I love the fact that like they took all, like his workers should have like killed him. by all, like in all, in terms of like what he represented to them in terms, I don't know. That's like, but then I'm projecting my own political desires.
This really took a dark turn in like the last 4 minutes of the podcast.
No, because this guy is like, he killed this Tiny Tim kid. He did. And like, just thinking that, oh, if he's just nice from now on, and if he just pays his workers,
that's true.
More,
it would,
it's all fine.
You think, like, it would be pretty easy to get away with murder at that. I mean, he has no family. There's like no forensics at that time, really.
Yeah.
They could just, would just disappear. His body would be heating that office, and the Cratchit family would move into that swank apartment.
Well, because he moves into Jacob Marley's house, no problem. Yeah. He doesn't mourn him at all. He just kind of, and so this thing of like, oh, if we just shake these cold, heartless people with enough sentiment. And because the people reading this are middle class generally, right? Like, and upper class, like, it's not the working, like, the people, some people consume it, sure. Like people consume it in different ways, and people are having it read to them and stuff. And, but like, you know, I can't help but think that there is that to this day, we still have this very pernicious thing of, if we could just get our elites to be nicer, to be better people, then, you know, things would be much better in our society. It's like, no, if the elites didn't have the power, they'd have that much better society.
I mean,
so that's the thing of me, and that's maybe that's why I like Scrooge, even though it's the same message at the end, right? It's like, oh, just be nice to your black female you know, assistant, and rehire the executive back, but that order is going to remain, right?
But don't,
like,
cede,
it's still
your power because you're been abusing it for decades.
Yes.
Yeah,
for decades.
No. Totally. I mean, I think partly why it works so well in the original story is because, like, it's a pretty, like, low-key operation. Like, he's not running a factory. He's not, you know, I mean, he's... Yeah,
he's a clerk. He's some sort of, like, bean counter.
He's abusing Bob Cratchit and other employees in certain versions. But, I mean, it's this tiny little grubby office. It's such a small scale. I mean, I don't know if it's in other versions, but, like, certainly in the Disney one, like, he makes Bob Cratchit his partner at the end, which...
Yeah, he gives him a raise at the end of the novel, I think.
Yeah. Again, I think that's a good edit. Like, his partner's dead at the beginning. He's mean to this guy. He should make him his partner at the end. I know what you mean. Like, but I think that's what's great about the story as a Christmas story. Like, it's about redemption. It's about, and that's why I think it is, like, kind of like the ultimate Christmas story, because it's something that you don't age out of like you do some other Christmas stories. It gets, like, richer as you get older. It becomes, you know, it's become seeing Christmas not as like a time when you get presents or as a kid, or when you necessarily like go to church and believe in like the theological aspects of the holiday. It's about like this day as a day to like reflect on who you are and maybe like try to like envision the world outside of your own narrow perspective, or even like
become worldly, yeah. Read about the world, read about other characters. Like, there is this thing of like read, like, think about other people, go to other places. Like, that's the kind of, like, open your heart to other people. I mean, really, it's the message of, I mean, if you've read Frankenstein, like, this Frankenstein has the same similar kind of elements, because under at the heart of Frankenstein is about a man with no friends. And a man who, like, shuts his heart off to all the sort of social connections. And instead, he just makes this creature as his legacy, right? I mean, the analogy isn't perfect. But I can't help but think that, like, a sad man with no friends. And again, this orphanhood theme and the sort of legacy of his dad's brutality and his kind of just general friendlessness and his money-grubbing nature, right? That he embraces this vast wealth that's hitting the country. And so Dickens is kind of writing about this class of people who are all of a sudden coming into this huge hoard of wealth. Like, the institutions that, like, we visit when we go visit London are built in this time. It's not some mud hut from like the 14th century. It's like a big shiny brick building that, like, cost a lot of lives to make, both literally and figuratively, in the sense of like the resources it took and like the people it required and like the cheap labor that was used to kind of like just whatever. And so Bob Cratchit actually is actually like a, if he works in this kind of office, he's actually not a middle class guy too. He's like a, or he's not a lower class guy. Like, he's not like a worker. We have, like, this is ultimately a story
about 38 children.
I mean, he's got like a house and stuff. I mean, yeah, it's like, you know, it's interesting. The class resonation. I mean, you have to go like a real scholar for like this nitty gritty stuff. But Yeah, the it is a different mixed message, and it's a lot of what happens in a lot of Dickens books, which is like, if you're just a good person, if you're just a good person, you know things will work out. I mean, not really. That's simplifying it big time. But like, you know, like Miss Havisham's end, right? And like, look at the way Miss Havisham ends, or Abel Magwitch from Great Expectations.
I think you're just messing with me, and you just made those names up.
No, both of them die brutal deaths, and they're like punished for the crimes they've done to their adoptees, right? But Ebenezer Scrooge is like given this second chance to like adopt his kids and to like adopt this family as his own family, and like they essentially adopt him. So it's like,
I take back endangering your child. Can I have a mulligan exactly. on that near yeah. child murder?
Yeah, your child almost died because of my lack of concern for you. So yeah, what's your favorite?
I mean, I think I've got to go. I mean, I love the Alistair Sim performance, but like, there's some weird stuff around that movie, namely that yeah. Tiny Tim is like a strapping 22-year-old
rugby player.
Linebacker. Yeah,
yeah.
But I just love, I mean, for me, like, if we're talking purely rewatchable, it's definitely the Muppet version. And it's funny because I think, like...
That's my second favorite now.
But it's also, like, the reasons why you like Scrooge, I think, are kind of the opposite of what makes this work. Because you were talking about, like, the romanticizing the past and, like, putting it in this kind of, like, fable-like context. I mean, that's very much, like, the Muppet one. Like, I mean, it's all yeah. sets. But what I love yeah. about the sets is that, like... They don't look right. They're all like weirdly angular. Like,
yeah. Oh god, that opening shot with the yeah. miniatures is beautiful.
Like, but it is like beautiful, and it is like romantic, and it is like this kind of like quaint version of like old timey London. But it also looks dirty, and it also looks like it might fall over at any minute. Yeah. You know, like there's yeah. this sense that like it's this kind of very perilous time in a way, and I just love it. And the music in it's so good. Fuck, it's just so good. I'm going to go watch it right now.
You get to watch, you get to re-experience all these things because you have kids.
Well, we've already watched it. They've already
You get
seen
to
it.
Do all these. So that's the thing is
and
that
I
like,
never
so for me, Christmas, but Christmas isn't like a thing in my life, right? Like it's only textual consumption.
Wow.
And, but well, I love Scrooge so ghosts. Much. Well, that's the thing. I love Scrooge so much, and I love It's a Wonderful Life and all this stuff. And like, you know, of course, who doesn't love going to parties? But like, not that parties happen anymore. And not that I was ever really invited to any party, what am I saying? But like that, those things are great. Those are the secular things of Christmas. And the fact that like, there is a kind of canonical list of Christmas movies that, and then in that a subset of those, or like the majority, not a majority, but like a bunch of them are direct descendants of Charles Dickens's little thing that he wrote in 6 weeks. I was just reading it now. He wrote it in 6 weeks. Yeah. And he was like, and there is a kind of funny backstory to all this, is about like the goal of this book was to like make him enough money that he could like rent out a place. like there are like the lore of all this, of like, there's the Dickens, like Dickens is sort of the ideas man, the genius, the sentimental guy. But like, there's also like Dickens, the like 19th century writer who had kids to feed, who like yeah. had to hustle for his work, even though he was like a big author.
He also and, like even though, didn't he write like a follow up to this? He was like supposed to write. He was going to write.
There was
a
like four
holiday,
books, right?
Yeah, he was going to like write yeah. a holiday thing every year, and his follow up to A Christmas Carol was like a story about New Year's goblins or something.
Something like that. And there's a whole. Yeah, and this whatever. Actually was preceded by something else in Pickwick. Like, he had been on this vibe, and it just congealed in this book and this story that became a sensation. And, you know, it's just like the, you know, it's all there. Like, it's, we're still talking about it 200 years.
We're still talking about
book,
it.
But we're still talking about this guy. This guy was born 200 years ago. We're still talking about his work. So,
oh my God.
We'll say, yeah.
You're right.
If only we had that kind of longevity.
The Chimes, by the way, was the name of that goblin New Year's Eve story. The Chimes. Okay,
that's
Sina,
awesome.
Thank you so much for doing this. Is there anything you wanted to plug before we wrap up?
Yeah, if you listen to the, like, go download the episode of East is a Podcast where, well, I just reposted it. I republished it. God bless the lack of copyright on that stuff. It was last year, and subscribe to my podcast. You might like it. I behind my Patreon.
The Orson Welles one?
The Orson Welles one, yeah. I might even release a different, because it, there's a no. I reposted it last year, but maybe I'll do it again this year for
Careful,
Christmas.
Careful, the Descendants could come after you. Drew Barrymore. No, could take legal action.
Yeah. No, I checked. This one isn't copyrighted.
Okay, good.
Because his stuff all went out. I don't know, the radio stuff. Because he like had, anyways, it doesn't matter. But yeah, go check that out and check out Easy as a Podcast. And yeah, I'll I'm gonna have to have you on for something. You always come on my show, so it's now it's my turn to come on your show. Actually, it's been two times.
You mean the
opposite. Since I've been on your show.
Yeah,
that's true. You always come. I always come on your show.
Wait,
you have to come on mine.
It hasn't been two times. You've been on the show like six times.
No, but two times in a row. Actually, and you haven't been on my show ever.
No, that's true.
That's true. Okay, can we do an Ewoks episode? The racism of Ewoks?
Yes, definitely. All right, well, until next time, you can find us on Twitter at Rewatchability and on Facebook and Instagram and all that stuff. And you can subscribe on whatever podcast thing you listen to. And until next time...
The balcony is closed.
I was going to say, watch out for ghosts.
Bah humbug.
No, don't say that. That's the thing that got that other guy in trouble. Okay.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.